This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the fallout after a duly elected Member of Parliament appears on a program peddling COVID conspiracies and other lies. Also, China threatens retaliation as the US pulls officials, though not athletes, from the Beijing Winter Olympics over the mass incarceration and torture of China's Uyghurs. Former Socceroo Craig Foster tells me other countries should join.
You know, we are talking about one of the most egregious and larger scale human rights abuses for a very long period, and something has to be done.
And more troubling stories from the disability community. An 86-year-old grandmother told by the NDIS she should be the main carer for her disabled granddaughter after a family tragedy.
You know, particularly at night, if anything happened, you know, if I had a health crisis of some kind, Laura wouldn't be safe. She wouldn't understand, and it would be very difficult.
Welcome to the program. An ugly episode involving an Australian government MP is courting widespread condemnation today. The MP is George Christensen, and he's appeared on a US-based conspiracy theory podcast called InfoWars that's been so troubling it's been deplatformed by all the major social media channels. During his appearance, Mr. Christensen laughed as host Alex Jones compared Australia's quarantine facilities to Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp where more than a million Jews were murdered. And he called on people around the world to rise up, including in protests at embassies. David Lipson takes a look for us.
The United States is thick with bad information these days, but the InfoWars website and program is so offensive, it's been banned by YouTube, Facebook, and Apple. Here's a taste.
The reason there's so many gay people now is because it's a chemical warfare operation. I have the government documents where they said they're going to encourage homosexuality with chemicals so that people don't have children.
It would be laughable if it wasn't so serious. Its host, Alex Jones, has for years claimed the Sandy Hook mass shooting that killed 20 first-grade children was a hoax, sending parents into hiding from abusive supporters of the dangerous lies. One family's had to move 10 times. Now COVID conspiracies underpin the program, and one of its latest guests, an Australian Member of Parliament.
George Christensen joining us from the authoritarian police state that Australia has devolved into.
Describing the host as a beacon of freedom, Mr. Christensen agreed with spurious claims about the COVID vaccine, called on people around the world to protest at Australian embassies.
It really does embolden the patriots.
And said this in regards to Australia's quarantine system.
They're all rounded up and put into these junked up jail cells, which they call quarantine camps.
Well, we were just showing one of the new quarantine camps, and it looks like it's got electrical fence being put up at the top. I mean, it looks like something out of Auschwitz or something. Why would you need these big fences and guard posts?
That comment from the host was met with a chuckle from George Christensen.
We condemn any association to anything of the evil Nazi regime.
That's Employment Minister Stuart Robert with some of the strongest condemnation of his coalition colleague.
Completely and utterly inappropriate for anyone to make light of the Holocaust and the devastation it occurred. It is flat out vile, is condemned.
Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce, who's currently overseas, has previously resisted dressing down his colleague over COVID disinformation. Former leader Michael McCormack says it's not good enough.
When you see bad behaviour as a leader, you have to call it out. You can't just say, I'm not going to poke the bear, I'm not going to prod the bear. Barnaby needs to call this out, and he needs to call it out as soon as he's able to.
Labor frontbencher Katie Gallagher went on the attack.
The Prime Minister should be taking action. I can't imagine a situation under any other Prime Minister where a member of their own government would be allowed to free range like this with dangerous ideas and either not be kicked out or stop doing it.
Late in the day, a statement from the Prime Minister. I denounce the comments in the strongest possible terms. It said, the Holocaust was an evil abomination. Respect for the victims requires that it never be referenced in such a trivial and insensitive manner. Dr. Josh Roos is a senior research fellow at Deakin University. He says the pandemic has acted as a catalyst for fringe conspiracy movements and their supporters.
10 years ago, no one had heard of any of these groups. 5 years ago, they started to gain some momentum. And in the context of COVID and the intense disruption, both economically but socially, and the responses of governments that have been attempting to do the right thing but flawed on many instances, this is a perfect storm of circumstances that creates and builds momentum for these far-right extremist movements.
He says by appearing on such a show, an elected member of parliament amplifies and legitimises its message. Is it dangerous?
We know that there's all sorts of violence linked to the US far-right. So we know that it's dangerous, but we also know that it's dangerous at a deeper level because, again, it's sowing distrust and it's an attempting to polarise and undermine people's belief in media, in our politicians, in our government, in our institutions, and to effectively, to that extent, undermine democracy.
Should we as journalists call it out? There's some reluctance, I think, to draw attention to these types of incidents. But how should we approach this?
Not engaging with key actors and spotlighting individuals and building that personality cult, but really focus and honing in on where are these groups coming from, what are the preconditions that give rise to them, and how can our political system better effectively engage and develop policy to reach people before they get to this point. And that takes time and energy, but really that's what's required.
Dr. Josh Roos from Deakin University speaking with David Lipson. Well, Australian sports human rights activist Craig Foster has welcomed the US decision to impose a diplomatic boycott on the Beijing Winter Olympics, which start in February, and he says Australia and others should join. And the former Socceroo says while it's a stand against the mass incarceration, torture and cultural repression of China's Uyghur people, it is also a message to the International Olympic Committee for granting China the Games in 2015, despite evidence of crimes against humanity. The Biden administration says with China committing egregious human rights abuses and atrocities, US officials won't be attending the Games, though athletes remain free to participate. I spoke to Craig Foster earlier.
The big question here is around why the IOC hasn't raised questions about the Uyghurs. And in the absence of that, in the absence of their commitment to human rights, then fans, sponsors and governments have to make or take every action possible to make it clear that it's unacceptable. You know, we are talking about one of the most egregious and largest scale human rights abuses for a very long period, and something has to be done.
So is the target really not so much China, but the International Olympic Committee and sponsors?
Yes, that's extremely important. What should happen is governments all around the world and fans and sponsors have to start to question the IOC around their lack of adherence to, their lack of respect for, and their lack even of recognition of basic human rights in the countries where they are granting tournaments. And I might say it's not just the IOC, it's also FIFA, who recently have tried to grant a number of tournaments to China without the human rights order that they are obligated to undertake.
The IOC is already under pressure over its handling of the matter around tennis player Peng Shuai and her allegations of high-level sexual assault. We don't know if she's safe or where she is exactly. Is there any sign that the IOC's human rights position is shifting?
No, there's not. And it's not going to shift without pressure from outside of the IOC. So clearly we go, I mean, this has been going on for forever. So you go back to the 1936 Olympics, you know, with support of the IOC of Nazism or the support of international sport, including the IOC for South Africa during apartheid era. This has been going on forever in global sport, and it's largely because of this concept of false neutrality. So sport has convinced both itself and the public, sadly, and even sadder, I think many athletes, including Olympians, have been convinced that sport should go into countries and pay no regard whatsoever to what's occurring within those countries, either around the sporting events or more broadly. But surely when it comes to crimes against humanity and genocide, it's time for the world to make IOC and FIFA, but IOC in this context, recognise that that is no longer acceptable, that you have a responsibility to the broader concept of human rights and to the way people are being treated in that country. I mean, we should have learned that during apartheid.
So you obviously think Australia should join the US in the diplomatic boycott?
I think there should be a range of countries, even though, you know, virtually every country in the world has issues regarding human rights, and I'm one of the most vocal opponents of Australia's humanitarian conduct right now, including refugees and Indigenous rights and others. I do think that every country that is prepared to do so should be joining this diplomatic boycott to communicate to the CCP that what is going on with the Uyghurs is something different. It's something more egregious. This is a level of human rights abuse and atrocity. This is crimes against humanity as recognised by United Nations, by the EU and others, that we have to do something about.
China says this is politically motivated and pretentious in response to the US announcement. It says the US should practice a more united Olympic spirit. Your response to that?
Oh, I agree that we all should have a united Olympic spirit, because Olympism is supposed to be about humanism, it's supposed to be about equality, and it's supposed to be about non-discrimination. So this is discrimination of a religious minority, which has occurred with Tibet previously, of course, but which is on a global scale. It's on, you know, we're talking about several million people here. So the real question, I agree with the CCP there, this is what we should all be practicing. That's very true. But the question is, so how do we apply Olympism when it comes to the treatment of people broadly? Well, what we should be saying is that the Olympics and FIFA and the major global sports are at last going to uphold and enforce basic standards of human treatment in their own sports and in the countries in which we're hosting these major events. One way for that to happen is athlete activism, and we've seen a tremendous amount of that around the world. But athletes shouldn't have to any longer carry the personal career burden of speaking out. Sports have to do something, and so too do governments.
Craig Foster, thank you for your views today.
My pleasure.
Sports human rights activist and former Socceroo, Craig Foster. Well, the Victorian Ombudsman has levelled stiff criticism of decisions made under the state's recent border crossing scheme, saying some decisions were unjust and at times inhumane. Deborah Glass is not critical of the decision to close the border in July as such to protect people from the coronavirus, but she says the scheme put too much weight on keeping people out rather than finding safe ways for them to return home. Samantha Donovan has more.
The Victorian Ombudsman, Deborah Glass, agrees the state government's decision to close the border in July this year was lawful on public health grounds, but she says thousands of Victorians were affected in ways that few could have contemplated.
People told us they were not able to get exemptions to farewell loved ones at funerals, attend vital medical appointments, care for sick family members, or return home to care for animals. Some found themselves effectively homeless and caught up in a bureaucratic nightmare.
More than 33,000 applications for an exemption were made, but only 8% of them were granted. The Ombudsman found health department staff had only 30 seconds to categorise each application, and the overwhelming majority of them expired before they got to a decision maker. Ms Glass says her office received more than 300 complaints,
including from people who said they were paying double rent with no job, caravanning pensioners with no internet access, asked for documents they did not have, and a farmer who was afraid of having to destroy her animals. One complainant was asked for evidence of her sister's cancer diagnosis, treatment and life expectancy, and a statutory declaration from her elderly mother. People were not given reasons for the refusals or an avenue of appeal. It appeared to me that the department was putting significant resources into keeping people out rather than finding safe ways of getting them home.
Deborah Glass says the border permit exemption scheme led to some of the most questionable decisions she's seen in her time in office.
Rather than fairly considering individual circumstances and risks, the exemption scheme was a blunt instrument that resulted in unjust outcomes, potentially for thousands of people.
The Ombudsman is recommending the Victorian Government acknowledge the Health Department decision makers rarely exercise their discretion and come up with ways to avoid this happening should border closures be necessary in the future.
You know, what came across for me was a culture of caution within the department that put a greater level of emphasis on keeping people out. The guidance specifically said the reasons had to be compelling for people to be able to return. So applications were simply not processed because they weren't able to provide the huge amount of documentation that they'd required.
David Davis leads the Victorian opposition in the Upper House and is calling on the Premier, Daniel Andrews, to apologise to those who were locked out of the state unfairly.
This was botched from the start. But this was unfair, it was unjust to people, many thousands of people stuck across the border. This was harsh, poor administrative decision making and, you know, very, very cruel impacts.
Victoria's Health Minister Martin Foley says the Victorian Government will consider the Ombudsman's report.
The arrangements that were in place were sadly necessary at the time. They are no longer in place. Now with a highly vaccinated our community and delivering the national plan, we've been able to do away with those restrictions.
Victoria's controversial new pandemic laws are now in force, and the Ombudsman Deborah Glass says they provide for more transparency where orders are made to exclude people from the state, and human rights assessments of those decisions would be available for all to see. She's encouraging health officials in other states to take note of her findings.
Samantha Donovan with that report. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, WA moves to regulate short-stay accommodation. Could it mean the end for many Airbnbs?
It would restrict you that you had 60 nights in a year, which defeats the purpose of doing that. You know, it would devastate, especially an area like we are, because there wouldn't be enough accommodation in peak season. There's already not.
The inquest into the deaths of St Basil's residents has heard that a senior Victorian health official concluded that elderly residents who were infected with COVID were safer at the facility and didn't need to be sent to hospital. The inquest was told that when some residents were eventually taken to hospital, they were barely conscious and dehydrated. In the end, 50 residents died, some of COVID and some of neglect. I've been speaking with our reporter covering the inquest, Emily Burke. And part of the St Basil's tragedy is that residents did not receive the care they needed and were entitled to receive, and that the decision to evacuate them all to private hospitals was made weeks after the outbreak began. So what's now known about the private hospital capacity at the time?
Well, we don't have specifics on bed numbers, but we know that multiple private hospitals were engaged to respond to the pandemic. In fact, there was a recently recommissioned private hospital which had been owned by La Trobe University and leased to Healthscope, which runs multiple private hospitals. Healthscope had spent the first COVID wave gearing up for this very scenario. By the time of the St Basil's outbreak, in fact, Healthscope had already taken residents from another aged care facility, Menarok in Essendon, to that centre. We heard yesterday there was no impediment to do it. The Commonwealth wanted it to happen. They wanted 40 of the COVID-positive residents at St Basil's to be sent to hospital urgently because they had concerns there weren't enough experienced staff to care for the residents. But when the St Basil's staff was stood down and they did a handover to the surge workforce, Terry Simons, the Deputy Secretary of the Victorian Health Department, deemed all positive residents were safe where they were. They didn't need to be moved to hospital. A day later, he was of the opinion that a hospital transfer could be disastrous and that the ADF should be called in. And he explained that some aged care operators had been waving the white flag and sending COVID-positive residents to public hospitals rather than managing the outbreaks in-house. Crucial to this is that the state was relying very much on the Commonwealth's ability to get enough replacement staff to take over from the St Basil's workers who were in isolation. But as the crisis unfolded, as we know, not enough workers could be found.
So what happened then?
Well, the picture has been painted with really a wicked problem and a terrible dilemma with sick or potentially sick elderly residents at St Basil's while their carers were ordered home to isolate. And the reality being that the health and hospital system was under strain, there was a risk of possible spread of infection in the community and in St Basil's, and the demand for clinical workers was outstripping supply in both aged care and in hospitals, and there were many outbreaks across the state at the time. By the 24th and 25th of July, however, St Basil's residents were being taken to hospital, and the health scope, Chief Medical Officer Victoria Atkinson, who was handling the intake of those residents, said she was given 5 hours' notice to hold 20 beds for residents. All of them were hypoxic from COVID and either deeply unconscious or barely conscious. So getting them to drink by themselves was very challenging. All of them were in an acute situation and needed double nursing teams and were put on IV fluids. Worth noting late today, Linda, very late today, that the lawyer representing the St Basil's managers, Con Contis and Vicky Koss, were both summoned to appear for next week, but they've made a submission to the coroner objecting to giving evidence on the grounds that they may incriminate themselves. And the coroner is considering that request.
Emily Burke reporting. Well, there are more troubling stories emerging within the disability community. This story is about the treatment by the NDIS of an 86-year-old grandmother, still grieving the loss of her son, who had been the full-time carer for his daughter, who has a significant disability. With his loss, she says the NDIS has judged that she, at 86, should be the carer for the young woman who has complex needs. Rhett Burney has our report.
Liam Thatcher is 25 and works full-time as a disability appeals advocate in Adelaide. He has a 21-year-old sister, Riley, who's studying nursing, and a 24-year-old sister, Laura, who lives with severe intellectual disability.
In terms of day-to-day care needs, she really needs someone to really assist her. That includes things like bathing, toileting, preparing food.
Liam, Riley and Laura's parents, Jennifer and Shane, doted on their kids. They were teachers at the same school in regional South Australia and enrolled Laura there, so they were never too far away when she needed them. Then in 2007, Jennifer died of breast cancer and Dad Shane became Laura's full-time carer. But 8 weeks ago, he died suddenly and Laura went to stay with her grandma. Liam and Riley temporarily relocated from Adelaide to help with Laura's care.
We put in a request to notify the NDIS about a change of circumstances, maybe a couple of days after Dad passed away, putting it front and centre that Laura needed some additional support for accommodation and things like that. It took them 2 weeks to respond to that request, which made us really anxious and quite concerned. We don't think the NDIS fully understood the real urgency of the situation.
When the National Disability Insurance Agency finally did respond, the family applied for extra NDIS funding to allow Laura to have full-time supported care in Adelaide so she could be near her siblings. It was knocked back. Marlene Thatcher is Laura's 86-year-old grandmother.
There does seem to have been an assumption that because I'm here, because I have been available to accommodate Laura since Shane's death, that I can continue to do that. And I really can't, you know, particularly at night. If anything happened, you know, if I had a health crisis of some kind, Laura wouldn't be safe. She wouldn't understand and it would be very difficult.
Mary Mallett is head of the Disability Advocacy Network Australia.
It isn't fair and it's not completely inappropriate that an 86-year-old grandmother should be expected to now pick up the burden.
Mary Mallett says a push by the federal government to rein in NDIS spending, citing sustainability concerns, is driving the agency to cut funding for the people it's meant to support.
As it happens, the NDIA has a relatively lean operational budget in terms of the number of staff. The only place they can take that money from is from the plans of the people who are already participants in the scheme. That's the only place that it can be cut from.
Marlene Thatcher says instead of grieving the loss of Shane, her family is appealing against the NDIA's decision. It's a process that, at best, takes months.
For all of us, not having that opportunity to grieve as we need to do has also been very difficult.
We requested an interview with NDIS Minister Linda Reynolds. She didn't respond. We also put several questions to the National Disability Insurance Agency, asking if it expects 86-year-old Marlene Thatcher to continue to care for Laura. In a statement, a spokesperson said the NDIA are making contact with Laura's family to reassure them the agency will continue to work with them to meet Laura's support needs. Liam Thatcher says, like his late parents, he just wants what's best for his sister.
She's always smiling and cheerful and everything else. And, you know, we enjoy spending time around her. She really needs this rolling, constant support to be adequately cared for. And on the day-to-day level, it's really important that someone's here that understands her needs and can respond to them as they arise.
Adelaide man Liam Thatcher, who's trying to get NDIS funding for his sister Laura. Rhett Burney with that report. Well, a new front has opened in the struggle to regulate the so-called sharing economy as the West Australian government proposes new rules for holiday accommodation services like Airbnb. The popular global platform allows owners to rent their homes or rooms in their homes, but it's led to all sorts of issues for neighbours, for the housing market and the traditional holiday accommodation sector. And there's predictable pushback to the idea of regulation in an industry built on none. Isabel Masali reports.
Paula Morgan loves renting out her property to those looking to explore WA Southwest.
We live in a very beautiful part of the world, and it's an opportunity to make like a bit of extra income and share your space with people that don't have the opportunity to experience it.
But Airbnb hosts could soon find it harder to operate under the WA government's plans to further regulate the sector. The draft proposal includes rules like requiring holiday homes to be on a statewide register, but it's a proposed cap that stood out to most. Short-stay accommodation providers could rent their properties for up to 60 nights a year, but beyond that, they'd need approval.
It would restrict you that you had 60 nights in a year, which defeats the purpose of doing that. You know, it would devastate, especially an area like we are, because there wouldn't be enough accommodation in peak season. There's already not.
No surprise, but Airbnb has hit back at the plan, describing it as among the harshest measures in the country.
And I think that the effect of them would be to really make people who share their homes in WA worse off, make holidays more expensive for families, and actually cost jobs in regions where tourism and holidaymakers play a big role.
That's Derek Nolan from the Australian and New Zealand branch. He says Airbnb is willing to work with governments on some regulation, but caps like this one are not the answer.
In New South Wales, there are caps of 189, but that's in places that have, you know, really serious pressures. Most of New South Wales doesn't have caps either. And councils are given the option to impose caps where they think there's a need. And we think a model like that could work in Western Australia. Unfortunately, what the state government has done is it's trying to regulate a 21st century industry with 20th century laws, and that just won't work.
The proposal comes after a parliamentary inquiry prompted by concerns of traditional accommodation providers and councils frustrated by antisocial behaviour at some holiday homes. The Australian Hotel Association has welcomed the plan, and it would come as a relief to many in areas where locals are now struggling to afford a rental. Parliamentary Secretary for Planning, Jessica Stokowski, has stressed the 60-night cap is just a proposal, with a consultation open until March. But she says change is needed.
We understand that 60 is dramatically lower than what's available right now, which is why we're putting it out for people to make the comments about how much they think is an appropriate time. We don't want to restrict people's opportunity to make income from their own properties, but we also need to be really aware that the short-term rental use of them can impact on the neighbours adversely sometimes.
Professor Nicole Gurran from the University of Sydney has been researching the impact of short-term rental platforms. She believes a 60-night cap is a sensible approach and should be considered in other states.
Internationally, cities like New York, San Francisco, Paris, and other cities around the world, they've confronted this issue probably before it's hit our radar in Australia. So nightly caps limits exactly what the Western Australian government has announced. That is a very standard, straightforward approach.
Nicole Gurran says short-stay accommodation like Airbnb isn't always problematic, But regulation like this is needed to recognise the impact on neighbours and the housing market.
Where there's a very restricted rental market for permanent residents, or in areas where you've got a very, very dense pattern of housing and where, you know, large groups, for instance, or frequent turnover of guests can have a real impact on neighbours, in those contexts, you do need a regulatory framework.
Professor Nicole Gurran from the University of Sydney, Isabel Massali reporting. And that's PM for this Tuesday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to the PM podcast.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Bois-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
In 2019, almost everyone thought they knew who would win the federal election, and most of them were wrong. This time around, the predictions are being made much more cautiously, so with a shadow election campaign already underway, what are the decisive issues?
Today on The Signal, we're looking ahead to the 2022 election with the host of RN Drive, Patricia Karvelas. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.